Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. What unites Theresa May, Hillary Clinton, and Lady Antonia Fraser? Well, they're all huge fans of my guest today, a Sunday Times best-selling novelist who's written 26 books, been translated into 35 languages, and sold millions of copies all over the world. She's been hailed as one of the best 50 greatest crime writers, and she's one of Venice's greatest chroniclers. She's here in the studio with me. Donna Leon, welcome to
Thank
Meet the Writers.
Thank you very much.
Now, this is actually the second time we've talked, mm-hmm. isn't it? We spoke a couple of years ago, and in that time you've written another two books.
Produzione industriale.
Now, you've travelled widely all over the world. You're speaking Italian there because, of course, that's where you live at the mm-hmm. moment. You live in Venice. But you started off in New Jersey. Take me back there.
Ooh. Yeah, I was born there a long time ago, 74 years ago. And for the first couple of years, I had the good fortune to live on my grandfather's cattle farm. They had them in New Jersey. I was a half an hour from New York, but at the age of four, I wasn't much interested. But I was interested in the cows. And so I am irredeemably rustic. I now divide my time between Venice and a small village in Switzerland, in the east of Switzerland, which is a farming village, and they have 300 cows. So and it's as if they've moved me home.
Tell me about growing up in New Jersey, though. So aside from the cows.
No, it was still not rural because it was a suburb of New York, a distant suburb. It was a lovely life. And uncharacteristically today, at least, I had a happy childhood. I had a wonderful childhood, raised on the farm until we were about seven. I was about seven. My brother was nine. Then we moved to a house in the suburbs. But it was an absolutely conventional life. My father went off to work in the morning. He read the New York Times at breakfast. My mother stayed home to take care of us. She worked part-time as a secretary. We had a dog. And we were happy. And today it seems that nobody's happy at home or nobody remembers having been happy at home. But we were just happy fools. I remember very clearly that my parents were terrible punsters, always jokes with language. They read a lot. In fact, my image of my parents' faces, my father resembles suspiciously the New York Times because he read it at breakfast every morning. And my mother read. After dinner in the evening, my parents sat down and read.
Do you remember the first book that really made an impact on you?
No. I remember the experience of saying to my mother when I was still a kid, seven, eight, however old kids are, and I said that I didn't have anything to do. I probably didn't know the word bored then, but I suppose I was bored. I didn't know. So my mother threw me in the car and took me to the library. And took me into the library, to the children's room. And what did I know? She said, well, would you like any of these books? And I looked around, and I remember taking a picture book of Egyptian history and looking at those pictures, and I had probably my first revelation that had to do with books, and I realized that everything was in that room. Everything that people knew was in that room. And from then on, I was hooked on the library, on the public library, and I still am hooked on libraries. I think they are a monument, certainly a monument to British culture, as they were a monument to American culture, mm-hmm. because people could go and get whatever they wanted to read and read about anything they wanted to read. It's the concept is still to me magical.
Mm-hmm. And that love of books, that love of learning, translated into a love of teaching.
Mm-hmm. I did all of the university and graduate stuff, and I worked as a university professor of literature for a long time, about 30 years. And it's because I love books, and I love talking about books, and I loved then the experience of teaching students who had read a book for the first time. If I was lucky, they had read it for the first time. And learning while speaking about the book or having to answer a question which they asked, I would learn something that I didn't know I knew about the book, about the importance. I remember ages ago, someone asked a question about why is it that people are always going to dances in Pride and Prejudice? And I thought about it for a while, and I said, because it was a way for men and women to be alone, to talk together. And the progress of their intimacy could be measured by the dancing that they did, the joy with which they met the other person to dance with. And I had never thought about that, although I had read the books many times. Because the student asked the question, I was forced to think about that particular element in the book. And that was one of the joys of teaching.
Do you think there's a danger that we sometimes overanalyze books?
And, absolutely.
And as a writer yourself, I mean, do you get annoyed by the whole, you know, but what was his real motivation? And perhaps you were, the subtext was this, when it really wasn't, you were just writing
the plot. No, I think people who write crime fiction are spared that, because the line of the crime book is relatively simple. There's a skeleton, or there's a path. And most of them are concerned with a crime of some sort and with the investigation of that crime, specifically who did it. I'm not much interested. Anyone who's read the books, I think, will notice. Yeah, obviously, I have to find out who did it. The readers have to find out who did it. But the interesting question in the books usually is why they did it. Mm. Because who did it isn't interesting. What is interesting and can be discussed is why.
Mm. So in terms of discussing books, you've discussed books all over the world. You've worked as a teacher in Saudi Arabia, in Iran, and in China. Tell me about those different moves.
In Iran, I went as a teacher of basic English to helicopter pilots. And I realized I was broke. I needed the job. And I'm very glad I went, because it's a wonderful place. They're wonderful people. It's so overwhelmingly beautiful.
When were you there?
I was there during the last years of the Shah, the four last years of the Shah. I quickly realized that I didn't want to be teaching. This is the main rudder. This is the thing that turns around, propeller. They're not called propellers, but they're actually propellers. This is the rear propeller. So I got myself transferred to the department that made tests and administered, after 8 weeks, they had to have a test. And we wrote the tests, and then we supposedly calculated how much they had learned by their multiple choice answers. But what this allowed me to do was sit in an office in the testing room, in the testing department, and have my 20-year younger tennis partner come to the door every morning for 3 years and go, whoosh, whoosh, Donna, come here, psst, Donna. So I'd get up, take a bunch of papers, and look at my boss and say, Pat, I'm going to take these papers over to the administration building. And I'd go out and go downstairs where I had stashed my whites and my tennis racket, and Jeff and I would go play tennis for 5 hours. And then I'd go back to the administration building, change back into, I couldn't take a shower, alas, but I could change back into my work clothes, stash the racket, go back up with the same papers and say, everything's in order, Pat. And this went on for years, because it was always sunny. I was the woman singles champion of the Esfahan Tennis Club. And finally, after about 3 years, my boss couldn't stand it anymore, because we were all united in this enormous hypocrisy that we were there to teach, but we were just there. Most people were there for drug, sex, and rock and roll. I went back into the office one day, and he looked up at me and he said, good game, Donna. So I had great fun in Iran. And then China was okay. There was too much respect, I think, that there was sort of veneration. And we were the first bunch of foreign experts. We were the first pair of foreign experts who went in after the Cultural Revolution. And it was still sort of iffy in terms of what you should and should not say. And Saudi Arabia was horrible. I hated it. I had the only time in my life when I wasn't happy, because I was graced with a happy upbringing. So I just assume that people are happy all the time, because I'm usually happy. But in Saudi Arabia, I wasn't. And I was treated as an eighth-class citizen. I was assaulted, and I was not to any great degree, but I was physically touched. Spiritually touched, I certainly wasn't, or emotionally. But I was touched all the time, and I was harassed all the time, and I was badgered all the time, and I was masturbated at all the time. So after 9 months, I was very happy to leave, and I'm very happy never, ever in the future to think of the possibility of going back to Saudi Arabia, because it was dreadful.
Well, and now, of course, you're in Venice and in Switzerland part of the time.
And that's nice.
How did you end up in Venice?
I went in the 60s as a tourist, in 68 or 69, and the following year I went back and I discovered a jeweler whom I asked to make a necklace for me. And she did. She agreed to do the necklace, and she made it very quickly. She made it in 2 days. And the year after that, I went back to thank her for it because I'd received some compliments on it. And she said, oh, come home to lunch. So I went home. And I still remember at the door to she was living with her parents. She said, ci diamo del tu. Let's call one another tu, which people did not do in the 60s. And it indicated a change in the way people could deal with one another. So I went in, I had lunch with her parents. And after more than 40 years, Biba, Roberta, and her husband are still my best friends, my best Venetian friends. And it is she who wrote the cookbook, Roberta Pianaro. Uh-huh. And we are just best friends. Christmas, obligation to be at Christmas dinner, obligation to call home every couple of days to assure them that I haven't been kidnapped or imprisoned.
How did she convince you to stay?
I kept wandering. But in 81, after Saudi Arabia, I called Franco and Biba from Saudi, I think, and I said, can I come and stay with you? Because I'm finished with this part of my life. So I went, I stayed with them for a while, and I found an apartment. But I knew when I went that that's where I was going, because by force of friendship, their friends had become my friends. Their families had become my families. And I think this is the difference, that I was adopted by two Italian families, by two Venetian families. And so my being sucked into the culture was being sucked into the Italian culture, into the Venetian culture. Mm-hmm. And I found a job teaching at an American university, and I stayed.
Tell me about your love of opera.
Ah, now we talk about something important. I was hooked by my first experience of opera. It was at the Old Met in the 60s sometime. It was before the New Met opened. And I saw Tosca with Zinka Milanov, the woman who made I don't know how many farewell performances. She was an Eastern European soprano of monolithic proportion, but with a monolithic voice. She was glorious. And I read the story of Tosca. I stood because I was in the family circle. And for the first time in my life, I saw it and heard it and knew what was going on. And I was blitzed by it, because hearing it without seeing it is completely different. When it works, when the magic works, for me, there's no artistic experience to match it. Hmm. Maybe reading poetry, but other than that, no.
So, of course, you've been involved with opera for many years. You're a patron of the Il Complesso Barocco?
I was until the death of Alan Curtis, the conductor, 2 years ago. And I am now involved with Il Pomo d'Oro, the golden apple, not the tomato.
Not the tomato.
Il Pomodoro. It is they who did the In War and Peace program with Joyce DiDonato, did the disc and did the program. And we're on tour with it in June all over.
So tell me what it is you actually do with the opera.
I am a good friend of the artistic manager and the general manager. And together we talk about what to do next and who to ask to sing it. I can consult with them about those two things, and I try to keep my nose out of everything else. Mm-hmm. Scheduling, programming, that's not my business, because I don't know enough about music to be able to say anything intelligent. But I like to suggest singers that they might not have thought of or might have thought of and I think need to rethink about, or argue strongly in favor of a particular opera to record next. Mm-hmm. We're recording Handel's Circe in October, I think.
And you often travel with an orchestra. You perform programs of music based on books that you've written with companion discs.
Yeah.
That sounds extraordinary.
Well, in Germany, this works because I'm much more known in Germany. And so we have two programs. One is the one I prefer, Handel's Bestiary. He wrote 31 arias about animals. And with Alan Curtis about 5-6 years ago, we were trying to think of what to do, what book to do next, that we could have both my texts and arias. Alan and I came up with the idea of Handel's Bestiary, because when I was in grad school in the dim historic past, I had written a long thesis about medieval bestiaries. and the concepts that they had of animals, which were completely wonky because they had never seen elephants or rhinoceroses or camels, but they drew them. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the manuscripts, particularly the ones in France, you see these wild pictures of these animals drawn by people who had heard verbal descriptions or who had read written descriptions of what these animals look like. The best are the elephants, who look a little bit like vacuum cleaners with very thick legs. So we did the program, and I wrote the texts about these animals, and a friend of ours, Michael Sova, who's a very, very clever, very gifted German illustrator, did the 13 drawings of the animals. And it was whimsical, and it was fun. And the stories are great. Bees are always busy, but if they get caught outside of the hive, the medieval bestiary writers knew, what they do is lie down at night on the wings, so their wings would be dry, because in the morning they'd hop up and go back to work. This is an example. Lo and behold, you too must in the morning rise up and...
Fantastic.
Oh, it was fun. It was really fun to do this.
So that's one strand of your writing, but of course the strand that we know you for mostly is writing mysteries. Mm-hmm. How did that start?
It started in the opera. I was in La Fenice with Gabriele Ferro, a Sicilian conductor, and he and his wife, also Sicilian, and I were talking about another conductor. And one thing, push led to killing him. And I thought at the time...
Not literally.
No. What if? And I thought it would be a very good idea to try to write a murder mystery about, which I had never thought of doing. I got the idea of writing a murder mystery because of that conversation, during that conversation. So I wrote a murder mystery because I had wondered, I wonder if I could. And then a couple of years later, a friend said, why don't you send it to this competition in Japan for murder mysteries? And because the idea was so absurd, I sent the manuscript off to Japan and I won. And then HarperCollins in New York bought the book and offered me a 2-book contract. So I had to write another book. And then they offered me 3 and 4 and I had to write more books. And then luckily, the books were bought by Diogenes Verlag in Zurich. And they, in essence, made my career because the books did not do well in America at all, nor in England. But Diogenes managed to position the books in the European market because, and I think they were interested in the fact that Brunetti was not an intellectual.
Who's your main character? He's your detective.
He's the detective, but he's sort of an atypical detective in that he's married and happily married. He has 2 nice kids. He has a wife who's a university professor of literature. He reads all the time, and they talk about books. He doesn't go home and drink himself into a stupor and fall asleep without changing his underwear. He's an Italian man with all of the tastes and good taste. He's worried about what he wears. He's worried about how he looks. He's very much interested in how people look, how they dress. He's very, very Italian in that. He also eats very well and knows the difference between a hamburger and pasta with zucchini.
And we have all of this in wonderful detail throughout the book, mm-hmm. plus the descriptions of his family. Now, his children, who never age, let's talk about that.
Mm-hmm. Next question. No, they're stuck in a time warp. And if someone were to bang my head against the wall and force me to tell the truth, I'd have to confess that the kids are in their 40s. But I don't want to deal with that in the book. So they are, it's eternal springtime for the family.
How do you remember, I mean, over 26 books, what it is they've done, where they've been, how all the kind of different plots link up with each other? I mean, have you got a sort of flow chart or something?
No. You have no reason to believe this, but when the book is finished, the book really is finished for me. I've never looked at them again. I sort of remember, but sometimes people refer to scenes from a book, and I don't know what book they're talking about. I remember vaguely the scene. Some of them I don't, but there's 27 of them, and so there's no way that I could remember them. But I have a kind of intuitive sense of how the people are maturing and changing. Certainly he's growing darker and darker. But I think the future of Venice is growing darker and darker. And as a Venetian, he would have to be darker because he couldn't be little Mary Sunshine about what's happening to it. The city where he was born and where his grandfather and his great-grandfather and his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was born.
Well, tell me about Venice. What's happening to it?
It's a story I can tell in numbers, dear. There's 58,000 residents in the city. 58,000. Last year, the Tourist Bureau talked about 30 million tourists. This year, when no one was looking, they slipped in another three, and now they talk about 33 million tourists. That's more than go to Thailand, who come into the city. I don't know how they calculate this number. Maybe they invent it out of whole cloth. As far as I know, they could. They invent everything else out of whole cloth. But if the number is true, one needs very little imagination to calculate the damage that this does to a city of 58,000 people. Think of the restaurants. They can feed anything to these people. If there's enough tomato sauce and enough Parmesan on it and enough mozzarella, it's wonderful. Or it's good because it's Italian because it has tomato sauce on it. Mm-hmm. And so the number of restaurants where Venetians will go diminishes because more and more of them are taken over by people who will sell anything and be full. Mm. It manifests itself in the things that are for sale in the city. Go and try to buy buttons. Go and try to buy a zipper. Go and try to find a shoemaker, which are things that people live in a place might need. Certainly the shoemaker is a dry cleaner. Tourists don't need those things, but they need, or they think they need, masks, all of which are made in China. Tourist little statues of glass, most of which are made in China. In the island of Murano, the glass factories close year after year after year. More of the glass factories in Murano close. And yet more and more glass shops open up in Venice. The numbers on this don't work either. Hmm. If there's less production and more sale, where is the glass coming from if it's not coming from Murano? If it's not coming from Murano, it's not Murano glass. Mm. So all of these numerical things, the cruise ships, they displace, I think, 342,000 liters of water, whatever that means. And yet the laws of physics have been suspended by the Tourist Bureau because they assure us that this displaced water doesn't bang up against the sides of the canal through which the boat is passing. The numbers don't work. Where does that quantity of water go? Does it rise up in the air? Does it go to fill the fountains in the city? Are we drinking it? But the numbers simply do not work in favor of the continuation of a life for Venetians.
So how do you navigate it? How do you live in Venice?
I'm like someone in South Africa who avoids the migration of the wildebeests. I do not go out when they are crossing the rivers. I have to use back streets to go to where I want to go. And since I've lived there so long, I can get to places without passing through the migration. But if at any time in the weeks that I'm each month in Venice, I have to cross over the Rialto Bridge or go close to the Rialto Bridge, I can't use the back streets anymore, and I have to deal with that passing down Oxford Street on Christmas Eve. Mm. And it's the same thing. Mm. And this is, I go back tomorrow for Palm Sunday. I won't leave my house. And then Easter Sunday, I leave. I'm leaving on Wednesday. I go back tomorrow and I leave again on Wednesday because I do not want to be, I can't be in the city for Easter. I don't want to do that to myself. But it remains the most beautiful place I've ever been. Still, it is. And it's where most of the people I love live. So I'm drawn back every month.
And what's extraordinary about it and about your writing, the fact that you're so well known for these books, is that you have never been translated into Italian. They don't know who you are.
No, that's precisely the reason for my boycott. Because I am an American. We are democratic, alas, only with a small D. And when a person is a celebrity for any reason, very often they are treated with a kind of deference that gives me the creeps. And so where I spend a lot of time, I would prefer not to encounter that kind of deference. And by not having the books published in Italian, I can avoid that. No Italian who has read the books has been in any way offended by what I've said about the city. The only interesting comment, other than I like the book, has been, it is very strange that someone who is not Italian and who is not a Venetian can understand and say these things. But I've lived there. I lived there for 30 years, and I kept my eyes open and my ears open. And my friends are Venetian, and so I can repeat what they have told me.
Mm. Now, because they are mysteries, mm-hmm. I don't want to talk in any detail mm-hmm. about your latest book, but in it, Brunetti finally mm-hmm. gets a break in Earthly Remains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he gets a break, and he goes out to Sant'Erasmo, where he goes rowing, and he spends, I think, 200 pages in the Laguna. This book is the most unashamedly ecological book of the series. The idea of the ecology and the ecological danger, which we all face, has appeared in previous books. Mm-hmm. There's a scene in an early book where he's taking a long shower and the kids come up and go, thump, thump, thump on the door. They're the water police, he thinks, and it's treated as a joke. And then 5, 6, 7, 8 books later, Signorina Elettra has declared that all of the garbage in the Questura has to be separated into paper, plastic and metal, and residual, apple cores. Mm. And this is sort of treated as a joke. But the joking's over in the books. And this book is very, very serious about the ecology not only of southern Italy, but of northern Italy. And the crime is very much caught up in the ecological catastrophe that is Italy mm. and other countries in Europe, but particularly Italy.
Yeah. Was that a conscious thing? And is it something you try and put in all of your novels, that you do have this kind of core message?
No. In fact, I fight against it because I'm not Jimmy Swaggart. I'm not a preacher. It's not my job to preach to people. My job is to amuse them. My job is to keep them turning the pages, to give them something that they enjoy reading, and to suggest to them, hey, take a look at this. Just take a look at this situation. What do you think about that? How does that register in your mind, in your politics, in your serious thinking? But only to present the problem without reaching an obvious judgment about the problem, about the cause or the future of the problem, because that's not a fiction writer's job. And I don't want it.
You do a fiction writer's job extremely well.
Thank you very much.
Donna Leon, thank you so much. Donna's latest Brunetti novel, Earthly Remains, is out now. It's published by William Heinemann. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Sam Impey, Claire Urban and Anthea Longo. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.